Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Christopher Beale in for Eric Jansen.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
It seems like it's been quite a few years since those of us in the LGBTQIA community had to hear news stories about our very rights being debated in the U.S. Supreme Court. Same with women's rights. That is until recently.
We will hear argument this morning in case 19-1392, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization.
This past December, the justices heard arguments over a new Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country, and 50 years on, they stand alone. Nowhere else does this court recognize a right to end a human life.
Many legal observers who were there in person believe the court's conservative majority could undercut Roe v. Wade and Casey v. Planned Parenthood. Those are the 1973 and 1992 decisions that have, up until now, upheld the right of women to have an abortion. Could that right go away in the wake of a Supreme Court decision? And how does all of this affect the rest of the LGBTQIA community? Joining us with expert analysis is national politics and legal affairs correspondent for the Bay Area Reporter, Lisa Keen. Welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you.
How was your holiday, Lisa?
It was great. I mean, we just took down the tree and everything yesterday. So, you know, I feel like, okay, the holiday's over. We're into 2022. Let's do this. How about you?
It was really nice, relaxing, not long enough, of course. And like you said, now right back to work at the top of the year. And in your specific field, the Supreme Court has been quite busy during this season, especially as we move into the new year. And there are a number of important cases being weighed, namely a woman's right to an abortion. That is, again, under attack. What exactly is the Supreme Court considering right now? Like, what's on the line?
Well, there are two cases that the legal activists are keeping their eyes on right now, that both of them have already been argued, and they involve attempts to ban abortion in Mississippi and Texas, state laws to ban abortion. And many legal commentators concluded after those oral arguments that they think the court is actually looking at overturning Roe versus Wade. And they think that might actually make it possible for states to begin banning abortion significantly, not just very late term abortions, but abortions after as early as 6 weeks, which would really eliminate most abortions. So, you know, the consequences go beyond just abortion for many, many reasons.
You mentioned that we're 50 years after Roe v. Wade made abortion legal nationwide. Why do you think 50 years later, abortion is back in the spotlight?
First of all, I would say that people who are opposed to abortion have been trying to undermine or overturn Roe for 50 years. And they've been trying to chip away at it and everything. But things have changed primarily because the court has changed. We've had conservative courts before, but this is the first time that we've had like a 6-3 conservative court, making it much more possible that the support for seriously undermining Roe versus Wade to take place, for there to be a realistic chance of it to take place. The 6-3 really came about just before the election in 2020 when Trump appointed Amy Coney Barrett to the bench. She made number 6, which really just gave a lopsided strength to the conservatives on the court. So I think that's why things have really picked up. But I mean, anti-abortion activists have always been trying to overturn Roe versus Wade.
You mentioned that they're probably their closest now, but have they ever come close before to overturning it?
I would say no, not really overturning it. That's really almost always seemed like an impossibility. They've been chipping away at it, saying that it would be okay to ban abortion in very late term or under certain circumstances. But this is the first time that I think there's been a real serious threat of overturning Roe and enabling states to begin banning the majority of, if not all, abortions.
Obviously, abortion is an important issue for women, but I wonder, should all LGBTQIA people be watching these decisions on abortion? Like, how can this affect the rest of us?
If it becomes okay for states to say whether or not a woman must carry her pregnancy to term, whether she wants to or not, whether it threatens her life or not, if we say it, if it's okay for states to ban that, then it doesn't seem at all far-fetched for the court to say, well, it's okay for states to regulate other very personal decisions concerning one's bodily integrity. And that could be who you have sex with, whether you choose to have your uterus or breasts removed, whether you request transition surgery or use PrEP or use the condoms. I mean, let's face it, forcing a woman to carry a pregnancy to term is a very dramatic and serious invasion of a woman's right to privacy and bodily integrity. If we're going to say it's okay for states to do that, I don't see it as much of a stretch at all to allow states then to start banning other activities which are equally private and involve our personal bodily integrity.
I wonder if the high court rules against abortion in the Mississippi case or in any of the others, what precedent would that set? And how do you think that precedent could affect marriage equality or any other LGBTQIA rights?
If the courts start undermining these longstanding precedents, Roe's been with us for 50 years, Planned Parenthood versus Casey has been with us for 30 years. Think about this. Obergefell, which is the decision that said states could not ban marriage licenses for same-sex couples, that's been with us for 6 years. Not 50, not 30, six. U.S. versus Windsor, which struck down DOMA, was just 8 years ago. And Lawrence versus Texas, which said states couldn't ban people from choosing to have sex with someone of the same gender, that was 18 years ago. So it is worrisome that if they strike down these very long-standing landmark decisions on abortions, that I think it's going to make us feel extremely vulnerable for what they might go back and try to do concerning LGBT-related decisions.
Do you get any sense, or does anyone really have any way of knowing which way the justices are leaning in this case? Like, do you have any suspicion?
I just have one suspicion, because first of all, I would say most journalists who cover the court for a while know better than to try to make a prediction, because you just can't read those tea leaves. It just can't be done. However, having said that, I will guess, not predict, but guess. My sense of Chief Justice John Roberts is that he will do everything he can not to overturn Roe. I don't see him as just lumping himself in with a 6-3 majority to overturn Roe. I would guess what we're going to get is something that they call a plurality decision, where there's a bunch of very fine points made about laws concerning abortion, and there'll be five justices agreeing on one point, but then a different combination of five justices agreeing on a second point, and that kind of thing. It's going to be probably one of the thickest decisions ever released by the court, and I suspect very complicated and nuanced, and it'll take forever to read and understand the full implications of the decision. But that's the only thing I will predict, that it will be thick, it will be complicated, and will take a long time to really understand what the impact's going to be.
Let's just assume the worst for like just a second.
Okay.
If the opponents of abortion get their way, what are we looking at? Like, how bad could this get? What's your worst case scenario?
First of all, let me just say this quickly. I can't foresee a case that's going to come along and undermine the right for same-sex couples to marry. However, I do believe that what will happen is that a lot of entities that declare themselves to have religious beliefs against same-sex marriage will find all kinds of contexts in which to say, well, we shouldn't have to recognize this marriage in our venue, you know, sort of like the Catholic Social Services Agency did in Philadelphia. They said because of their religious beliefs, they would not entertain the idea of placing a foster child with a same-sex couple. So I think we'll just get inundated with those kinds of cases where entities are going to try to carve out exceptions. That's not good for us, because I think same-sex couples would like to be treated like everybody else and feel like that their marriages are respected in all aspects of society. So I think that's one of the things that we can anticipate happening. I've seen two looming trends. One is this religious thing where various entities are claiming a religious reason to discriminate. And I think also that the public's confidence in the court is likely to change dramatically, because I think if there's a big loss here, public opinion is going to be, well, that happened because you've got all those conservatives on the court. You know, like I said, with Amy Coney Barrett being number six, making this kind of super majority over here, I think it's going to undermine everybody's confidence that the court can rule on constitutional issues in a neutral and fair way. It's going to be seen as highly politicized. But it's like the importance of precedent. The reason precedent is important is because it gives the public a sense that you've got this neutral body that is going to rule fairly on what the law is and not be playing politics with every decision that comes down the pike. Because if the court becomes political, if the court's seen as political, people are simply just going to expect that, you know, in another 20 years, then we'll have a different composition on the court and the law will change back. That's not a good thing for law. Law needs to be stable.
Do you think the Supreme Court has become political?
Well, I would say that certain members of the Supreme Court have shown themselves to be very political. Samuel Alito comes to mind. He sort of completely tore off his mask of neutrality in the past year. So I think certain members are. I think Chief Justice Roberts and maybe a few others are trying very hard to stay that kind of neutral arbiter of what the law is. But we'll see what happens, Chris. I mean, we'll see.
When are we expecting a decision on this? Do you know?
I wouldn't expect it until the end of June. Typically, the court issues its decisions on really controversial issues at the very last days of the session, which are at the end of June. So because this is a complicated and controversial issue, in fact, because these are very complicated and very controversial issues, end of June. And then the court leaves town and tries to avoid listening to the harangue.
What can we do at this stage as citizens to affect this? Or are we just way past that point?
This isn't a short-term battle. To try to establish equal rights for LGBT people, it's a lifelong battle. It always will be, I think, just like it is for African Americans and others. I think what we can do as individuals are to give financial support to our legal organizations that are fighting very hard and working very long hours and strategizing in really important ways for how to preserve the rights we have and to even achieve new protections in many arenas. And the battlefronts are so many and so varied, they really need as much support as they can. I think we can also, as individuals, stage protests. I remember back in 1986, after the Bowers v. Hardwick decision, which was the decision that said states could ban people from having sex with someone of the same gender in the privacy of their home. That caused a huge explosion of protest on the front steps of the Supreme Court. And my sense was that the court was very moved by that, and so was public opinion, and so was the attention of members of Congress. I think those protests help. I really do. I think because they show visibly, hey, we're here and we don't like this, and we're citizens too, and we deserve our rights. Sometimes we have to clamor for our rights. And so I think those are two things we can do. Obviously, there's other things. You can write to various public officials. You can write to newspapers. You can try to reason with people who are in your life that don't understand or who are maybe even hostile. So those latter things are ones you have to sort of be careful about, because you know, sometimes people like to dig in. So it takes some finesse to try to persuade someone who is of a total different opinion that to try to see life your way, just to see what, you know, what it's like. There's always stuff we can do.
You're listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. I'm Christopher Beal, and for Eric Jansen, my guest, Lisa Keene, is the National Politics and Legal Affairs Correspondent for the Bay Area Reporter and LGBTQIA papers all across the country. We've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and how the cases the justices are considering this term could affect LGBTQIA rights. You can read some of Lisa's reporting on this and other national courts and political issues on her website, keenenewsservice.com. We'll include that link on our site. outinthebay.org in the post about this week's show. That's outinthebay.org. And while you're there, please consider making a donation to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Out in the Bay is a nonprofit independent production, which means we get no financial support from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay weekly. Not from NPR, not from podcast platforms, just from listeners like you. outinthebay.org. Lisa, what else is the Supreme Court working on this year that might especially affect the LGBTQIA community?
A lot of it is religious oriented. I know there's three cases in particular that we are most immediately expecting the court to signal soon whether or not it intends to hear these cases or not. Two of them involve religious employers who want to make negative employment decisions based on a potential employee's sexual orientation. The third case is one that's a variation on the Masterpiece Cake Shop case that everybody, I'm sure, remembers from just a few years ago. In this case, it's a graphic artist who creates websites for couples that are getting married, and she's decided that her religious beliefs prevents her from creating these websites. And I'm sure everybody's seen one. If you've ever had to go to a wedding, you know what they are. You know, Susie and Jimmy are getting married. Here's
the gift registry and all the
things.
Exactly,
yeah, right? Yeah. So somebody has to make those websites. Right. And this woman makes them, and she's like, I won't do them for same-sex couples. So she's trying to refuse based on her religious beliefs. So that case is before the Supreme Court. They could very well take that up. I mean, I think because they didn't really rule on the merits in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, there's a good chance they'll take it up. All they need is four justices to say, yeah, I think we got an issue here we need to look at. And
here we go again.
Here we go again.
There's a few other issues headed to the court as well, aren't there? Like trying to restrict gay books and libraries.
Right.
What's that about?
This is where I am predicting that we're going to end up in the Supreme Court. Maybe not this year, or maybe it'll be late 2022, not in this particular session. And that is, we're seeing a lot of things percolating on efforts to, once again, ban gay books from libraries, ban them from schools, again, based on religious reasons. I think there's been the continuing efforts to try to ban the use of bathrooms and locker rooms by students who are transitioning. there's even attempts by teachers in some cases refusing to address a student by the student's preferred pronoun or name, saying that their religious beliefs require that they refuse to respect the student in that way. And of course, there's cases that are already in the pipeline challenging the right of trans women to participate in women's sports competitions. I think all of these are headed for the Supreme Court. It's just a matter of what time they'll end there, but they're all going to be really important cases once they get there.
I can't help but think with abortion and gay marriage and trans bathroom issues and access to women's sports, all this stuff still being debated in the highest court in the land, does it feel to you like we're going backwards?
Yes, yes, it does. It does. But I don't think we are going to go backwards. I think religious activists may try to change the law to stop abortion, to stop recognition of same-sex marriages in various contexts. But I don't think society, or at least not the majority of society, has any inclination to hurry back to the 1950s. I just don't sense that's going to happen.
So would you say you're not worried about it?
It's like I said before, this is a long battle, a never-ending battle to maintain equal rights for LGBT people and for others. It's never ending. What gives me hope that we won't go back to the 1950s in any significant way is that it is that 1986 case. I was there for that, and it was a dark day in LGBT history when the Supreme Court said, yeah, states can ban the right of an individual to have sex with a person of the same gender. It seemed, you know, I remember it was a time when LGBT legal activists quietly among themselves said, we got to stay out of that court because we're not going to get any ruling. We're just going to hurt ourselves by going to the Supreme Court. But here's the thing. Following that decision, gay people didn't go away. I think if anything, more and more and more LGBT people came out, and they came out in droves because they had to protect their rights. They had to stand up for themselves. And of course, with the AIDS crisis occurring, it was a matter of life and death, too. They really had to fight for their lives as well. So I just don't see all of a sudden the courage and fortitude of millions of LGBT people suddenly evaporating. I think many people might be weary of the battle, but nobody's giving in on this. I think we're going to hang in there and hopefully justice will prevail.
Do you think that something needs to change structurally within our government, or is it just the way our government is designed that we keep revisiting these things over and over again?
You know, now that you mention it, there does seem to be something structural that we can just keep bringing cases. And okay, so today I bring a case and I win to do one thing. And tomorrow somebody who feels totally different brings a case to try to do something else. I mean, our system does allow for us to do that. This is it gets back to where the courts being political might be doing our country such a disservice, because we rely on a neutral court to maintain some stability. In other words, not to rule today one way and then tomorrow, because they've got another person on the court who will support it, rule another way. The court is supposed to enable us to have a strong reliance on law and how it is interpreted and how it is applied to every citizen through time. That's the importance of precedent, is to try to provide that kind of reliable understanding of what the law is. So, you know, maybe structurally there is a little bit of a flaw, but I think we're just going to have to live with it, because I don't think democracy means shutting down change. I think it means responding and adapting to change.
Is there anything that the Supreme Court is considering this time around that you're actually excited about?
No. I wish I could say otherwise, but I feel like most of the things we're watching for are not any place where I expect us to advance. I expect us to, if there's a victory, the victory is in hanging on to well-earned rights, you know, rights that we fought very hard to get, like recognition of marriage equality. Now it'll be a victory just to hang on to that. It was a year or so ago the court ruled on Title VII. It was a huge victory. That was a, you know, I don't see anything big like that coming in the near future. I think right now we're back on the defense, and these are extremely important, just like in football. Defense is just as important as offense. So I think we've got to play both the whole game.
Lisa, how can people keep in touch with you and your reporting?
Well, in San Francisco, my legal coverage is carried by the Bay Area Reporter, and I'm in gay newspapers in other cities around the country. And you can also see my reporting at keennewsservice.com.
After all these decisions come out and we start making more sense of what's going through the Supreme Court, will you come back and explain it all to us?
You bet. I'll do my best. Thanks.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest, Lisa Keen, is the national politics and legal affairs correspondent for the Bay Area Reporter and LGBTQIA papers all across the country. We've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and how the cases the justices are considering this term could affect LGBTQIA rights. You can read some of Lisa's reporting on this and other national courts and political issues on her website, keennewsservice.com. We'll include that link on our site, outinthebay.org, in the post about this week's show. That's outinthebay.org. That's where you can hear past shows, hear this show again, and share them with friends. And please do that. Word of mouth is our number one form of advertising. You can also sign up for our occasional email newsletter so you don't miss any episodes. And that's where you'll find the Out in the Bay podcast as well, outinthebay.org. And while you're there, please consider making a donation to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Out in the Bay is a nonprofit independent production, which means we get no financial support from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay weekly. Not from NPR, not from podcast platforms, just from listeners like you. We want to thank Brad Payton and Richard Merck of Silicon Valley for their generous support, and also Cornelia Enders and Bud Dillon of San Francisco. We'll thank you on air only if you say it's okay for us to do so. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. Thanks to KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area and San Francisco Public Press and its radio station KSFP 102.5 FM for broadcasting Out in the Bay weekly. Out in the Bay was created by Eric Jansen. I produced and engineered this episode. If you want to join our team, you can email us at outinthebay@yahoo.com to learn more. You can send comments there, too. That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. I'm Christopher Beal, filling in for Eric Jansen. Thanks for joining us out in the Bay and at outinthebay.org.